So she's, as her, I'm from Department of Pharmacology and Therapeutics. The major focus of research in my lab is signal transduction, specifically signaling interaction between estrogen receptor and tumor suppressor P53, mainly in breast cancer, but more recently also in lung cancer and ovarian cancers. So today I will be taking you through some of the basic aspects of signal transduction, how it works. And it is some of these pathways might appear to be pretty complex when you look at the textbooks, the Weinberg's cancer textbooks or any other articles, including the article I gave you to read before the lecture, but don't be intimidated that I'll try to simplify the concept as much as possible so that you get a better grasp of the principles behind. The most important thing is not all the minute details or the names, but the concepts behind each pathways. So I've picked up few representative pathways to demonstrate the principle. That does not mean that they don't even scratch the surface of all the transduction pathways that are actively present in any given cell. But to give you a principle, you don't have to know every single pathway, but certain principles that which can be applicable to all of them. So you have already thing been given, not by me, but this particular review paper, and as you already might have read that for the other lectures, some of the fundamental aspects of cancer cell is sustaining proliferative signaling, and then a cancer cell has to evade growth suppressors, obviously, and it has to activate invasion and metastasis to go from one place or the place of origin of the tumor to the rest of the body. And also it has to have enabling replicative immortality. In other cells, these cells have to have the ability to keep on multiplying indefinitely. That's one of the hallmarks of characteristic of cancer cells. And inducing angiogenesis, when these cells, cancer cells, start dividing and becomes bulkier and bulkier, obviously the inner side of the tumors, there will be less blood supply because it is inside. So in order to provide blood supply to the tumors as a survival strategy, the tumor cells themselves activate certain pathways which would help to generate new blood vessels. That's called angiogenesis. And resisting cell death, the cell's proliferation is a sum total of cell division and cell death. Cell has to multiply, but at the same time, quite a few cells are dying too in any given organ. And that balance is what makes it a normal cell. But in most cancer cells, the pathways are designed in such a way that the cells are able to resist cell death, at the same time have the ability to proliferate or ability to divide without much of a control. An example of, specifically with reference to cancer, is given here, shown here from another textbook, Molecular Cell Biology. This is a relatively old diagram, but which is still very relevant. This was one of the colon cancer where one of the models of stepwise tumorigenesis was proposed by Bert Vogelstein years ago. So for example, in a normal colon, cancer could start as a small polyp, and that polyp could be benign or pro-cancerous in nature, because many of us, as the older we get, the chances of having a polyp in our colon are higher. That doesn't mean that all of us have cancer in our colon. Some of these polyps, different genetic alterations start happening. One of them is one of the tumor suppressors called APC. Another one is an oncogene by name KRAS that get activated, and then there is another tumor suppressor got deleted in, deleted in colon cancer, that's the name come from. And also one of the king tumor suppressors, P53, get inactivated by one way or the other. So all this happens step by step, and you can see in parallel the characteristic of this polyp also changes. This is a class two adenoma, which then becomes more advanced and then become class three adenoma. Still it is benign, it is not become complete cancerous. And then when loss of P53 happens in this particular case, that's the last straw, so to say, when from this benign nature it become a malignant tumor. And then quite a few other genetic changes, molecular changes happens, which enables the tumor or gives the ability to invade the into the through the basal lamina into blood vessels and lymph channels. And that's where the start of metastasis, which is the most dangerous part of cancer, and that's what kills a patient, not a localized tumor. So. No, I was a good question. I was just going to talk about that. No, this is only in the, in particularly the when Bert Vogelstein, his main research focus has been on colon cancer. So in that particular case, he found this disorder. It does not mean that all cancers have to undergo the same order. They are quite different. Say, for example, in many cancers, P53 is the very first event, even though here it is almost the last step from here to here. So there is no specificity in this particular order. So what is signal transduction? Signal transduction, it is the process of converting extracellular signals into cellular responses. So in our body or any animal's body, the cells are not, cells don't remain in isolation. They are in a they are among various other hundreds or thousands of cells where they have to communicate each other and coordinate their functions. In other words, it is a pretty democratic system. It's not autocratic that one cell decides everything, whatever happens in an organ. So it has to communicate. And that, so any given cell, there is an exterior and obviously an interior. So what signal it is receiving from exterior, extracellular, has to be converted to cellular responses. So that's the signal transduction. So signal transduction was years ago viewed as a collection of linear information transporting paths, pipelines, so one end to the other, or you may think of as a freeway, like connecting, for example, I-90 connecting Buffalo to Albany. So things happen from one end to the other. But now that over the years has changed. It has more like all sorts of roads, and we see in any given city, like there are several ways to reach one place from another place, not just one. So that's the concept of signal transduction. And that has evolved over millions of years in evolution, the purpose being that there is a lot of plasticity and a lot of adaptability in all of us, so-called higher eukaryotes. And the price we pay, obviously, is that anywhere, any major point in that get altered, it can lead to various diseases like cancer. And also assigned this, our challenge is that understanding this multiple pathways leading to multiple outcomes is not an easy task. If it is just one pathway, it's easy. So now we know that, as I said, the pathways crosstalk enables the signals to propagate through a tangled network of interconnecting networks and cascades. And recent findings from the genome research reveal another problem. There are fewer genes than biological processes. There are thousands of biological processes, but we have only about 20 to 20,000 genes at the most in the human genome. Earlier, before the human genome was sequenced, people used to think that our genes will be, since we are so-called the most evolved among the eukaryotes, our genome will be much larger, but that's not. Then spatio-temporal control is an important means by which signal transduction is regulated. Our understanding in this area is still lagging behind or far behind. In other words, the signal transduction happening in one cell in one organ may be different for that particular purpose in another cell in another organ. And also, even at same event or same signaling at a given time will be different at another time, depending on the cell's status, whether in terms of the cell cycle and whole bunch of other variables. So there is both a spatial and a temporal component in deciding particular signaling outcome. So about 10 years ago or so, thought that there would be about 100,000 genes because there are so many different proteins known. But now we know that we have only, as I said, about 21,000 or so genes. Many of these 21 genes can make multiple proteins each. But we are also discovering many other so-called non-coding genes, one example being non-coding RNA or small RNAs. And even there are quite a few other non-coding genes, which only very few are known, like 20 or 25 years ago. Some components of the ribosomes, for example, were RNA. Those things were known, or tRNA, which transfers amino acids to the proteins. Those things were known. But now we know that there are so many huge, hundreds of non-coding RNA with multiple functions to regulate gene expression. So the complexity has increased a lot than initially what was the idea. Now, the real answer will be more than 21 genes, depending on how you define a gene. In other words, do you count the non-coding regulatory genes? So obviously, that's the challenge we have. So the number, earlier idea of a gene which encodes proteins are mainly considered as genes has changed drastically. So this is just to show you the complexity as I was talking about. This is a more than 15 years old diagram from Weinberg, Hanahan and Weinberg, those recent review which you all have. So these quite a few new pathways have been discovered, this is not representative of all the pathways, obviously. The purpose of showing this old diagram, which is still very relevant, is that how complex is the various pathways talking to each other, as the arrows indicates here, from one to the other, from the cytoplasm, from all the outside membrane cytoplasm to the nucleus, to the different organelles in the cytoplasm, such as mitochondria, etc., etc. So if you just focus on how the signal transduction happens, so there will be, in most cases, there is a receptor sitting on the cell membrane, which are ready to receive signals coming from extracellular areas in an organ. It could be, for example, they are called ligand in general because it's a primary messenger which will attach to or bind to a receptor, and that's a very initiating point where a whole cascade of signaling starts. And so in one part of this receptor is embedded in the cytosol, and which subsequently a lot of changes occurs, like second messengers or second layers of molecules get activated, and that translates into cellular responses in the cytoplasm, and quite a few of them go into the nucleus and then gives out various outputs. And the same thing, a different version of this, is that the same receptor can lead to activate multiple pathways, as I alluded to in the beginning. For example, also two different receptors can activate the same pathway. In other words, two receptors will be able to receive two different signals, but both might end up activating the same pathway. So that's yet another basic concept in signal transduction. And then there could be two receptors receiving two ligands or binding two ligands and cross-activating multiple pathways downstream in this space, pathway 1 and 2, for example. So an expanded view of that particular principle is shown here. So these are a whole bunch of ligands, or these are the ones which convey the extracellular information to the cell, and these are all whole bunch of different type of membrane receptors sitting on the cell membrane. And from there, various proteins are cellular cytoplasmic proteins are activated, and as you can see here, they relay the information to whole bunch of other proteins within the cytoplasm. So these are in general considered as adapters, or some of them are enzymes, and they, as I said, one leads to the other one, the other one leads to yet another protein. So that's why it is called signaling cascades, and some of them ends up in the nucleus, obviously activating or repressing various types of genes, and the ultimate result will be those are obviously are called transcription factors. So the ultimate result of this process will be the output layer or various functional aspect in, of any given cell. For example, apoptosis or cell death, ability to migrate, ability to grow uncontrollably, or attach or communicate with another cell, or differentiation. You know, some of the cells can differentiate depending on the signal. So those are various results, outcome of this whole signal transduction pathways. Now there are different ways of these, how these ligands work, or gives rise to different types of signaling. And one of them is endocrine signaling, which you might have heard in your earlier years in school or college, which is the hormone secretion into the blood. See, the hormones are secreted, are produced and secreted at one place of the body, but they function most cases at a distant region of the body, because they travel through the blood vessel and reach yet another location. And so these are called endocrine signaling. And then paracrine signaling is that both the producer and the acceptor are residing nearby. See, for example, a secretory cell secretes some factors, and another adjacent cell would have receptors for that factors, and they can receive the factors and elicit a whole signaling cascade inside. So these are all called, these are called paracrine signaling. And then the another important signaling mechanism is autocrine signaling. In other words, the producer and the acceptor is the same cell. So the cell produces a growth factor, for example, and that growth factor is received by a receptor residing on the same cell. So that particular process is called autocrine signaling, and that's very important in the cancer process. Most of the cancer cells have their properties regulated by this particular signaling mechanism. As I said, in a normal situation, it's a very democratic process. You have to receive a signal from somewhere, another cell, to function. They have to communicate each other. But in this case, the cells have the tendency to be get autocratic, like they can decide irrespective of what the neighbors decide or what the neighbors want. They don't care. And then there is another variant of this paracrine signaling here. These cells are very close to each other, where there is a the product is the one of the proteins or the cellular proteins are projected on the membrane of a particular cell, and it is accepted by the receptor on another cell. So both are projected on the cell membrane. So that type of signaling also is there. But most important for today's lecture, especially in the context of cancer, this signaling becomes the most important one, autocrine signal. Now, years ago, a big break came into our understanding of signal transduction by the discovery of epidermal growth factor receptor, one of the very first receptor to be identified. And so that particular receptor has a ectodomain protruding out of the cytoplasm, and then there is a transmembrane hydrophobic region and a cytoplasmic domain which contains the homology, the sarcohomology, and along with a C-terminal tail here. And as you can see, they are of different length in terms of the amino acid. So the signal is received here, transmitted, and a whole series of reactions starts here downstream. And the surprising thing was that those days when this particular thing discoveries were going on, one of the main areas of cancer research were that how viruses cause cancer. Even though many of these viruses don't cause cancers in humans, viruses were known to cause cancer in various animals, like chickens, cats, dogs, and a whole bunch of other animals. So there were a lot of interest in studying them because people thought that understanding how these viruses cause cancer might give clue to human cancer. And it did give. One of these is shown here. They were looking at one of the oncogenes from one of these viruses, and that is called V-ERBB. The name of the virus was erythroblastosis virus B. That's why the name came from. And since it is viral, it is called viral those gene. So those genes were discovered in a lab which extensively work on these viral oncogenes. They identified this protein, and the surprising thing was that this has a lot of similarity with the cellular EGF receptor, as I mentioned. So at that time, it was a big surprise because nobody ever expected a viral protein to have that much similarity to a cellular protein. So it turned out that but at the same time, it is not the entirely same. Part of it was missing, actually, as you can. The ectodomain is missing most of it here. So what the viruses have done is that they have usurped a normal cellular protein and converted into an oncogene by deleting part of the signaling protein. So in this case, as I said, the signals are received here, as you saw few slides before. The ligands bind to the ectodomain. If the ectodomain is not there, the ligands cannot bind. So this protein, the viral protein or an oncogene, can elicit signaling irrespective of whether there is a ligand or not. It doesn't care from signals from outside. It always remains active. Blasting signals for cells to divide uncontrollably. So that was the purpose of this the viral strategy, to convert a normal cell into an oncogene. That was a huge breakthrough. And in fact, the two scientists, Michael Bishop and Harold Farmers, working on this concept, got a Nobel Prize several years ago for that breakthrough discovery. And that gave a lot of information how a normal protein in our body can be converted with or without virus infection into an oncogene. So in other words, all of us are carrying cancer in our own body, basically. There are potential proteins in the cells which can be converted to oncogenes. So the ERBB receptor family, it derives the name from a sequence homology, as I mentioned, to the avian erythroblastosis retroviral oncogene, VRB. The receptors of this family are also frequently referred to HERS, H-E-R-S. It stands for human epidermal growth factor receptor. So that's how the name HERS come from. And the members of this family include EGFR or HER1, HER2, HER3, HER4. So the first member is EGFR, as the structure you saw earlier, and that is also called HER1, and then there are HER2, HER3, and HER4. These names are showing because we will be encountering those names in the next several slides. So the structure, basic structure of these membrane kinases or membrane receptors, these membrane receptors are also called membrane tyrosine kinase receptors because they are activated by phosphorylation of specific tyrosine residues in their cytoplasmic tail, which we will get into some detail very soon here. So basically they have ectodomain, they may look different, but the basic structure is the same, ectodomain, membrane domain, followed by the cytoplasmic tail. So one particular factor called platelet-derived growth factor, like EGF, this is platelet-derived growth factor, was found to be closely related to sequence to the VCIS oncogene of simian sarcoma virus, another virus, which is an oncogenic virus. That was, its oncogene was found to be very similar to the PDGF, just as VERB was found to be very similar in structure to the EGFR receptor. So this particular receptor is found this particular virus transforms fibroblasts, but not epithelial cells. So that's an interesting information which gives some clues how these receptors can work in different ways. So even though the receptor is the same, but this virus can only transform fibroblasts but not epithelial cells. Why? Because the PDGF receptor is expressed on the surface of mesenchymal or fibroblasts but not on epithelial cell surface. So obviously if you don't have the receptor, even though the growth factor is there, the cells cannot respond. So the experimental example demonstration is shown here. These are the platelet-derived, the fibroblasts, fibroblasts, one without PDGF and one with the PDGF. So in this particular case, the PDGF was experimentally, receptor was experimentally removed, and then in this case, it was intact. So when these cells were exposed to these are both wild-type fibroblasts and these are mutant fibroblasts. These both has wild-type receptor or normal receptor, platelet-derived growth factor receptor, and these were where this receptor was mutated and taken out. So they don't have the experimentally removed in these fibroblasts. And then both these categories of cells were exposed to the growth factor PDGF. And as you can see here, and this is an assay called the wound healing assay. Basically, you have a layer of cells on a plate, and then you scratch it with a glass rod. So the cells will be in the, that scratch will be removed, and then you wait for several hours or a day or two, and then you look at how fast the gap is filled. That's an indication of how the cells are able to proliferate. So here you can see, even though the cells have, all these cells are exposed to the same growth factor, which is PDGF, these cells, the gap where there are no cells still remain, whereas in this particular case, where there is both the factor and the receptor, you can see that the gap is filled. So you need both the factor and the receptor to elicit its appropriate function. In these cells, when there is no PDGF receptor, even if you provide them with the growth factor, not much happens. Now, there are several examples of these tyrosine kinase growth factor receptors altered in human tumors, just to provide you a feel of this, not to by heart this table any means. So the EGFR or RB1 receptor, as I told you, they are altered by various ways. One way it is altered is overexpression, like more copies of those particular proteins or extensive are produced, and that's seen in non-small cell lung cancer, breast, head and neck cancer, and stomach, and whole bunch of other cancers. And sometimes the same receptors can truncate, or the truncation of the ectodomain, as I saw in the picture when I was comparing it with the viral oncogene, and that type of situation is seen in glioblastoma, lung and breast cancers. Again, another set of this another type of disruptor, HERB2 or HER2, as I mentioned earlier. Their overexpression is very frequently seen in breast carcinoma, breast adenomas, and HERB3 overexpression is frequently encountered in oral squamous cell carcinoma. So, like that. So, many of these receptors are found altered in various cancers. And now the question is, how do receptor tyrosine kinase, or RTKs, transduce signals from the extracellular space into the cytoplasm of cells? So just to zoom in on a particular, on any given tyrosine kinase receptor, membrane receptor, so it has ectodomain, membrane domain, and the cytoplasmic tail. And these receptors are on the membrane, but they are not active until they encounter a growth factor molecule. When they encounter a growth factor molecule, when they bind, they dimerize. These two come together, and then when they are dimerized, then in the cytoplasmic side of these proteins, what a process called transphosphorylation occurs. Because there are quite a few amino acids here which can be phosphorylated. All of these are tyrosine. That's why the whole name came from tyrosine kinase receptor to begin with. So these tyrosines can be phosphorylated. Now the interesting thing here is that this particular tyrosine in this amino acid in this receptor is phosphorylated by the companion receptor, and vice versa. Here the companion receptor phosphorylates the other one, and that's why it is called transphosphorylation. This is the very important step in the beginning of the cascade of signaling inside the cell once this is bound, the ligands bind the receptor. Now, how this process can be deregulated? In a normal cell, ligand binding is necessary for dimerization and subsequent signaling, so which are called ligand-dependent firing of signals. What could happen is that in cancer cells, mutations can affect the structure of these proteins, where they don't need to bind the ligand. Without ligand binding, for example, if there is a mutation here somewhere in this protein, they can remain active constitutively without a ligand reminding them to be active. So this is ligand independent firing. And another process by which ligand independent firing can happen is when there is too much production, too many of these receptors are crowded on a membrane. So the proximity of too many of them at one time can force them to interact, even with the absence of a ligand, and that's also the result will be the same, ligand-independent firing, uncontrollably. So both these type of things are very common in cancer cells. And then example of a normal epithelial cells and the mesenchymal cells in the normal signaling process. A tyrosine kinase receptor again, this is a ligand. For example, a ligand called transforming growth factor alpha is produced by another cell, and that can activate, bind the receptor on another cell and activate that cell, epithelial cell. Okay. And in, also, a given epithelial cell can produce another factor called PDGF, platelet-derived growth factor, and that in turn can activate a receptor sitting on a mesenchymal cell, a PDGF receptor. I already showed you, this is the receptor in that wound healing assay we were talking about. So basically what it is showing is that a growth factor produced from one cell can activate another cell, in this particular cell, epithelial cell. A growth factor produced by epithelial cell can activate a mesenchymal cell. So that's the paracrine signaling, which is usually found in normal cells. So that this is what you saw now. So in a cancer cell, what happens, as I said earlier, the cell produces growth factor, there is an active growth factor gene in this cell which become active and produces the protein, the growth factor, and that can bind to the receptor on the same cell and elicit signaling. So this is the autocrine signal in cancer cells. So for some of the examples here, certain lung cancers produce growth factors such as tumor growth factor, alpha, TGF-alpha, and also a stem cell growth factor called SCF, and an insulin-like growth factor, IGF. All these growth factors are produced, and the receptors for these are also produced on the same, by the same cell. EGF receptor, KIT, all these are different receptors which can bind these growth factors. So that's an example of an autocrine signal in cancer. So an extreme example of autocrine signaling is what is found in Kaposi's sarcoma, usually a cancer which affects quite a few immune suppressed patients or AIDS patients, for example. In this particular case, it is caused by human herpes virus 8, HHV-8. The tumor cells closely related to the endothelial cells that form lymph ducts in our body, the tumor cells produce a whole bunch of growth factors, PDGF, TGF, all these are growth factors, as well as receptors for these ligands. These are ligands for various receptors, and the receptors are also produced by the same cell. So the virus, once it infects these cells, encourages the host cell to produce the not only the ligands but also their receptors. In addition, the virus itself has the ability to produce ligands for the, for example, two ligands. One is the viral IL-6 and virus macrophage inflammatory protein and their receptors. So this is an extreme example of a virus. Not only it can take over the cellular machinery and force it to produce, force it to be an autocrine signaling cell, and it also itself produces both receptors and ligands to even further exaggerate that process. So we already saw that. So these are again examples of the tumors making autocrine growth factors. A whole bunch of almost all these cancers have one way or the other, they produce growth factors and the ligands for those growth factors. See, in this particular case, you see overexpression of EGF receptor and overexpression of its ligand TGF-alpha. So both are produced by the same cell, and if you superimpose this chaining of these cells, you can see that the red and green, and it becomes the yellow. So it's just to experimentally show that the same cells produce both ligand and receptor. Now, the important features of these membrane receptor tyrosine kinases are the lateral, one of them is the lateral mobility in the membrane. When they are free to move on a cell membrane, and then as you saw, they are able to dimerize, and then they are able to autophosphorylate. Autophosphorylate means the protein can phosphorylate themselves. So autophosphorylation is another characteristic of these tyrosine kinases. The family, I already told you about this. So these are various HER family members heterodimerizing or homodimerizing. So HER1 and HER1 can homodimerize when they are close by, or when there are various ligands here. They are all defined here. And 1 and 2 can heterodimerize, 3 and 3 can homodimerize, and 2 and 3 can heterodimerize. And yes, you can see here, the only one which cannot homodimerize is HER2. It is one of the major oncogenes oncogenes that is very active in various genes, especially breast cancer. So that particular receptor need another partner to make it active. It itself cannot dimerize. However, when it is overexpressed, it can be it doesn't need another partner to elicit signal, the overexpression of RB2 in various cancers. So how does overexpression happens? There are multiple mechanisms by which overexpression can result. One is gene amplification. Receptor, when the gene in a particular chromosome is amplified by various mechanisms, so then you have multiple copies of the gene, which means multiple copies of the mRNA, multiple copy and enhanced production of the quantity of levels of the proteins. And another way is that a single gene, its transcription start site, or where the gene starts transcription, can be how effectively the gene get transcribed to mRNA can be altered. If there is an increased rate of transcription, increased production of HER2 messenger RNAs or transcripts, which ends up as larger number of proteins. Yet a third way is that mutation in the receptor. This receptor can have some mutations which will activate its function. And yet another way, increased production of growth factor, the ligand. We are talking about so far in this case, a receptor. So the ligand also can be abnormally produced in large quantities, which means that the receptors, for these receptors, the ligands, more and more ligands are available. That also increases the propensity to convert a normal cell to a cancer cell. An increased lifetime of receptor at the surface. These receptors are on the surface, but they have finite lifetime. They are not permanently. Depending on the signal, once their job is done, they are taken into the cytoplasm and degraded. But what happens in a cancer cell is that sometimes, irrespective of the presence or absence of signal, these receptors remain on the surface without getting degraded inside the cell. So one of the diagrams in the paper I asked you to read is that one, for example, how the membrane receptors can be taken up into and degraded. That process is compromised in most cancer cells. So all these various ways, a particular factor such as HER2, a membrane kinase receptor such as HER2 can be activated abnormally. And an experimental demonstration of that one was like years ago, discovered in breast cancer. So when they looked at a bunch of breast cancer tumor tissues, they find that the DNA band corresponding to the gene were some of them for very huge, for example, here. And in some of when they look at RNA, for example, in this particular case, even though the gene dosage is not that high, but the RNA was huge. Those days, they didn't have the sophisticated technique like PCR and other methods. That's why you are seeing RNA blotter to estimate RNA. These days, most of us will do PCR to estimate how much RNA is there. So, and then when the regular protein immunoprecipitation, when they did that and ran on a gel, Western blotting, what they saw is that in some cases, in this particular case, protein is also high. And that corresponds to how they did when you look at within the tumor tissue by immunohistochemistry staining. For example, these two tumors have very, very intense signal indicating that they have large number of HER2 receptors. And also, the disease outcome in this particular case, breast cancer, for example, here, the outcome is dependent on the status of the HER2 gene. When it is not amplified, you can see the curve is flat, how long the patient survives. The patient survives much longer. But when it is amplified, the curve dips strikingly. It means that the death of the patient is pretty fast. So that's from various patient population, when you look at the status of this HER2 protein, they are correlated with the overall survival of these patients. And another way to activate these receptors is in some, it is happening, you can see that in various cancers. One receptor can fuse to another protein, part of another protein. And that gives them extra ability or properties which enables them to dimerize without a signal. For example, in this case, a receptor called ROS is fused to another protein called FIG. FIG is a protein which can dimerize itself. So if you have a piece of that protein fused to this genetically, and then you don't need a ligand for this protein to dimerize, so the abnormality. So this was originally, these fusion proteins were found in leukemia type tumors, but last few years people have seen that this can happen in solid tumors also, whether it is prostate, breast or lung. These type of chimeric receptors have been documented now. So that's one another way, because how it happens no one exactly knows, but cancer cells, the whole genome is under stress, and there is a lot of breakage happening in the chromosome level, and when breakage and fusion happen, some of these genes happen to get fused, and those who have the advantage will survive. So that's how this happens, some of the fusion genes in the fusion of the membrane receptors. And these are all, you know, other examples of the same process, like in this case, ROS, as I told you here, it fuses with FIG, PDGF can fuse with the BCR, and things like that. And you know that BCR-ABL is the well-known classic example of gene fusion, even though that is not a membrane type, it doesn't belong to this kinase family, but that's one of the very initial fusion protein found to be important for leukemia. Now, the signaling circuitry is pretty complex, and of the approximately 21,000 genes we spoke about, out of those, 580 genes encode various type of protein kinases. 40% of these genes generally generate alternatively spliced mRNAs encoding slightly different various structures of kinases, proteins leading to more than 1,000 distinct kinase proteins. So even though the gene number is that, but even 518 genes are encoding them, but it can lead to thousands of different kinases by these mechanisms. The same RNA produced can be spliced differently and produce multiple proteins. And of the 518 kinase genes, 90 encode tyrosine kinases, the remainder being serine-threonine kinases. We will see how they function in the signal transduction. So they are serine-threonine kinases, meaning they can phosphorylate serine or threonine amino acids. Among the 90 tyrosine kinases, 58 encode proteins with general structures of the EGF and PDGF receptors, as you saw in the previous slides. Now, each protein component of a signaling circuit must solve two major problems. One of the problem is the specificity. How can it exchange signals only with a small subset of cellular proteins that are its intended signaling partners in the circuit? So in a cell, you see all sorts of proteins. How does a particular signal protein able to select its right partner at the right time? So that's a big challenge encountered by the cell. How can this protein acquire rapid, almost instantaneous access to these signaling partners, doing so while operating in a viscous soup in the cytoplasm and nucleus? So it's a big sea of thousands of proteins, and how then a particular protein will find the right partner to provide the right signal? So that's a big challenge. So in order to get some insight into that process, we need to know the structure of some of the fundamental structure of some of the basic proteins involved in this process. So we need to know some domains like SH3 domains, SH2 domain, SH1 domain, etc. So as an example, looking at the protein oncoprotein called SARC, this was very first oncogene discovered. This is not a membrane receptor, this was a cytoplasmic protein, but in order to just to demonstrate these different domains, using it as an example here. So it has an SH3 domain, SH2 domain, and SH1 domain, as I mentioned. What do they do? So if you look at the SH2 domain here, they specifically can recognize a phosphorylated tyrosine kinase. So this is a binding site for the amino acid side chain, and this is a binding site for the phosphotyrosine. So if a phosphotyrosine amino acid is in a protein, it would recognize that particular phosphotyrosine. Now, every single phosphotyrosine is not recognized. There is a context specificity. How that specificity is arising is because if tyrosine is sitting here, and if there is another three amino acid on the other side or whatever, the specificity is determined by those amino acids. Only in a particular combination they can recognize these phosphorylated tyrosine. And this is the SH3, another component here. SH3 in any given protein can recognize proline-rich amino acid, another protein which is proline-rich. In other words, it recognizes proline amino acid. So these are all protein-protein interaction principles behind the complex signaling transduction. So as you can see here, it's talked about SH2, and it can be a kinase protein called FIPS, and a SARC is the one which I showed you as an example. It has an SH3 and SH2 domain. It's a protein kinase. So this SH3 and SH2 domain, these are just various examples. As you can see here on the right side, what they recognize. So these are also called quote-unquote ligands, similar to the ligands what we were talking about in the case of membrane receptors itself. So these particular type of protein domains in one protein can recognize amino acid on another protein, particular type of amino acid. In this case, phosphotyrosine is recognized. This particular domain recognizes also phosphotyrosine, but in this case, phosphothreonine is recognized. Another domain in the various proteins called 1433 recognizes a protein phosphoserine. So like that, a whole bunch of ligands are recognized by whole array of so-called receptors or other proteins. So basically we are talking about the interaction between proteins. So you have to have a particular type of ligands or a particular type of structure on a given protein to be recognized and bound by another protein. That's the one of the source of specificity comes from how these interacting partners operate. And yet another view of that similar a depiction of that is what is in figure 1 in the paper I asked you to read. So here, how does this modification start, whether it is phosphorylation, acetylation? They are all post-translational, after the protein is translated from their messenger RNA, right? So for example, in this particular case, as I told you, the SH2 group in one protein will recognize the phosphotyrosine in another protein. In also another PTB domain in protein can also recognize another phosphotyrosine protein. So more than one type of structures in any given protein can recognize a particular modified, post-translationally modified protein. And this protein can, this can recognize various proteins, which as far as it has this particular tyrosine and neighboring amino acids. And another example is ubiquitination, which is a signal for degradation of a protein. That also is using the same principle, that you have to have a ligand and a corresponding protein called a receptor to accept it. Acetylation is another example. So these post-translation modifications or PTMs play a very important role in signal transduction. They are mainly the determinants, or they are the ones which decide which protein will bind or talk to the other protein. And the advantage of those post-translation modification being used for this purpose by the cell is that these modifications are irreversible. They are not irreversible. They are reversible. So a protein can be phosphorylated now in a given cell. The same protein, if you look after another hour or two or three or five, that protein phosphorylation may not be the phosphorylation might have gone. It is reversed back to unphosphorylated state. So that provides the cell the ability to regulate various processes in a temporal manner. And some of these proteins where you see in various cancers, the examples are given here. SH2, which recognizes phosphotyrosine, is found, the example I showed you, the SARC oncoprotein, and another adapter protein called GRAP2, and scaffolding protein called SHRIK. And all these proteins, some of them you will see the next few slides. And the PTB domains recognize phosphotyrosine again. They are also found in these type of proteins. And SH3 domain is proline rich. They are found in SARC, obviously, and another protein called CRAC, which is an adapter, and another GRAP2. 1433 recognizes phosphine serine. It is seen in CDK phosphatase, BAD, which is an apoptosis regulator, and RAF, which is another kinase, and PKC stands for protein kinase. And bromo domain recognizes acetylated lysine. And those are in quite a few transcription factors and chromatin proteins, you will see that. If you have a bromo domain in one of those proteins, they recognize acetylated proteins and bind them. And pH domain, it is they recognize phosphorylated inositides. And that's shown, for example, that's seen in a protein called AKT or PKB. We'll see them soon in some detail. So here, this you already saw how they come together and transphosphorylate. And once they transphosphorylate, just a detail of that some of the phosphorylation events are shown here. This is a PDGF receptor as an example. And that's an IGF receptor on your right side. Both when they come together, two receptors, when they dimerize, you can see that all these phosphotyrosine residues are here phosphorylated, shown in red. When they phosphorylate, they can be recognized by various proteins with these type of domains in the cell. Proteins with the SARC domains are attracted towards these. Proteins with the PI3K, that type of domains are attracted towards these type of things. So various proteins are attracted to these phosphotyrosines. So it depends on which phosphotyrosine is phosphorylated here. And as I told you, the amino acid sequence, the context is important. So in here, the tyrosine is sitting in the YIYV, tyrosine, isoleucine, tyrosine, and valine. In this case, it is tyrosine, methionine, and glutamine, and methionine again. And so the context of these amino acids, the tyrosine is different, and those amino acids are also very important in the recognition process, because those are the ones which decides which protein will bind which other protein. Now, which proteins are affected once this binding happens? Like they come together, dimerize, phosphorylate, and then various proteins bind to the phosphorylated residue. Then what happens? How does this phosphorylation lead further to mitogenic response by the cell? Its entrance into a phase of active growth and division. So, how does that happen? So we were here. In the previous slides, somewhere here, the phosphorylated, an example here, a protein called GRAB2, GRAB2 is an adapter. It has an SH2 domain, therefore it can dock on to the phosphorylated residue in the tyrosine kinase receptor. And yet another protein called guanine exchange factor with the two SH3 domain can dock on to this protein. So once that happens, they are able to activate the neighboring RAS protein. The RAS proteins are located at the internal side of the cytoplasm, the membrane. This is inside the cell and that's outside. So usually they are inactive when GTP is bound. So when these proteins are nearby, when they interact with RAS, it gets the ability to bind the GTP, and it is in an activated state then. So that's how RAS signaling starts. It doesn't have to be always this protein component. It can be, for example, another way. The adapter can be, instead of GRAB2, it can be SHC, and then comes GRAB2, and then comes the guanine exchange nucleotide factor here. So here it is, the GRAB2, here it is HSC, then GRAB2, then the guanine exchange nucleotide factor, or JEF, which is SOS, is an example of such type of a protein. And then the signaling ensues. So there's more than one way to activate the RAS protein subsequent to the activation of the tyrosine kinase receptor on the membrane. So in some detail here, so we are zooming in now on here. How does this inactive protein become the active signaling protein? So this is the inactive stage, and the guanine exchange nucleotide factor, which you saw there, this comes here. This can come only in response to the tyrosine kinase receptor signaling before. So once the tyrosine kinase receptor is activated, the JEF becomes attached to that, because it gets bound to the tyrosine residues indirectly, and then it is can interact with the RAS protein and can enable the RAS to bind the GTP, and then this protein becomes active for subsequent downstream signaling. And once the signal is done, the protein has to go back to the inactive state to be ready for the next signaling event in a normal cell. So that is facilitated by another protein called GTPase activating protein. So GTP is converted to GDP by this enzyme. It's an activating GTPase activating protein, or GAP. So GTP hydrolysis occurs, and RAS become inactive again. So this cycle happens in a normal cell, and so only the activation occurs in response to signaling from the membrane. But in a cancer cell, what happens is that it can get stuck here. Once it is activated, it remains activated, and there is no going back easily. So how does that happen? That depends on the structure of the RAS protein. One of the very first oncogenic mutations identified in RAS protein years ago, there are particular amino acid mutated, you would see, and that when those amino acids are mutated, it binds to GTP, it holds it tight, it cannot be hydrolyzed. So it always remains in the active stage, whether there is JEF, whether there is kinase signaling upstream or not. So this is a structure based on the crystallographic structure of RAS. These red ribbon-like structures are alpha helices, the green ones are the beta sheets. So some of the amino acids which are very important is glycine 12 and glycine 61, and this is a GTP molecule sitting on the RAS protein when it is bound, the stick model here. So glycine 12 and glycine 61 are the most mutated amino acids in this protein in various cancers. When that gets mutated, the binding affinity to GTP increases, and it cannot be hydrolyzed back to the inactive state. So these are another look at the angle for looking at the same protein. So in order to show that what are the some of the amino acids mainly involved in subsequent downstream events once GTP is bound. Okay, so this is a PI3K activating region where it can bind and elicit PI3K downstream signaling. This is the downstream RAF signaling. So you will see an example of how that happens. So here what you see is the RAS, we were here, RAS gets activated by GTP, and then whole bunch of downstream signaling ensues. First one is that it can activate protein called RAF. It phosphorylates, RAS has the ability to phosphorylate RAF. RAF is usually in the cytoplasm, but when the membrane-bound RAS is phosphorylated, it can take up the RAF from the cytoplasm and phosphorylate it. And then the RAF will phosphorylate another downstream protein called MEK. MEK can phosphorylate yet another important player called ERK1 or 2. So this, you can see a cascade of phosphorylation to enhance the signaling here. First, if you think about the previous slides I showed you, this is the membrane, if you may, cell membrane. Tyrosine kinase is sitting here. Ligand binds here. It gets activated. Activated means the phosphotyrosine residues inside the cytoplasm get phosphorylated, which enables to bind a bunch of proteins called GRAP2 and SOS, and which will, in association with RAS, will activate it, and then RAS gets the ability to phosphorylate other proteins downstream in the cytoplasm. So RAF is a kinase itself. Once it gets activated, it can phosphorylate other proteins. So that's why the naming, another way of to name this is, if this is a MAP kinase, okay, ERK1 or ERK2, and so this is a kinase which phosphorylates a MAP kinase. That's why it is called MAP kinase, PKK. And this one, if you think about, this is a kinase which is capable of activating this one, MAP kinase. So therefore it is called MAP kinase. So that's how they can be named. So this is just to illustrate how the signaling cascade happens here. And once it is ERK1 and ERK2 are phosphorylated, what do? They phosphorylate subsequently another layer of proteins. And they are all very functionally important proteins for various functions. Another protein called MSK1, important in chromatin remodeling, RSK, and a whole bunch of S protein here are all ELK-SAP. All these are various transcription factors. It's just an example. It doesn't mean that these are the only proteins phosphorylated by ERK1 or 2. And once they are phosphorylated, they are very active in various signaling processes that enables the cells to divide uncontrollably. So another look at it is the same thing process. As I can see, the MAP kinase, this is the GTP RAS, interacts with the MAP kinase domain of RAF. It gets phosphorylated, and then the next one gets phosphorylated, the next one gets phosphorylated, and then whole bunch of proteins get phosphorylated. So it's another depiction of the previous slide. And once they get phosphorylated, as one of the earlier slides I showed you, the signal can be transmitted all the way to the nucleus. How that happens? So this is the exterior now again. The RAS protein is sitting here. The membrane tyrosine kinase is sitting here. The signaling from here reaches the RAS protein. Once it is activated, a whole bunch of things happened, as you saw in the previous slide, and MAP kinase get activated. Some of these MAP kinases can phosphorylate other proteins, and they enter from the cytoplasm into the nucleus, and they bind various genes. Just an example is given here. It's a gene which has a serum response element. In other words, this gene responds to the serum in the medium when you grow the cells. And that happens because various transcription factors can bind to that particular region of the gene promoter. And these active signaling kinases, what do? They phosphorylate those transcription factors, then they become active to drive transcription of this protein to produce particular proteins. For one example is a protein called FOS, another example is a protein called JUN. Just before that, as I told you, a whole bunch of proteins get expressed here, and there is a temporal control here. This is looking at the expressed levels of genes by a technique called microarray. You don't have to, for this particular purpose, you don't have to worry about the technical details, but all you need to know here is that these different vertical lines represent looking at a bunch of genes activated or at a given time. So if you look at 30 time, right before adding the excess serum into a medium where the cells are there, you can see the red indicates activated genes and blue indicates genes which are not active. So you can see here there's a bunch of genes here active, then active here and nothing here. Wait for 30 minutes. What you see? The active genes here are not that active, but the inactive genes which are blue here become intensively red here. See here. And then there was nothing here active, but here you can see the active gene. And that pattern further changes when the cell goes to 60 minutes, further changes when the cell goes to 2 hours. So this is how temporally dynamic that signaling is. Temporally dynamic signaling all the way from the phosphorylation to the active transcription factors, which ends up activating different genes. So that's what you see seeing here. Just an example, as I told you, if you look at a protein called FOS and another protein called MYC, they themselves are important growth factors in our body, but when they are misregulated or mutated, they can become oncogenic. So these two proteins, what happens, they combine to form a, I mean, they interact to form a complex, FOS and JUN, in that case, where MYC is another important protein. But if you look at here, what you can see here is that FOS is activated immediately within 30 minutes of serum stimulation. It goes, come down, peaks and come down. But CMYC, another important growth factor, it doesn't get to its peak until almost 2.5 hours or 3 hours. Sorry, one and a half hours, for example, here. So CMYC, then it goes down. So even though both are growth growth controlling proteins, their expression peaking and disappearing or coming down is different. So that's another way, and these are all dependent on what you saw previously here. When does these factors, these are, for example, if you imagine if this is a FOS gene, this is a MYC gene, when these factors are binding here, when they are activated, will depend on when these proteins are expressed. So they are very finely tuned temporally. Okay, so you see this one already. Now, RAS can activate another pathway called PI3K pathway, not just RAS. So for example, here, go back here and see here. Where was that? Yeah, here. See, some of these particular amino acids are involved in activating the RAS pathway, which you already saw here. For another surface of the RAS protein is involved in interacting with a bunch of protein to activate PI3K pathway. That's what you are going to see next. Here, okay. So PI3K pathway is the next one. So before we look at this pathway, you need to know something here. You need to know about the phospholipids, phosphoinositol specifically. So lipids are a major component in the membrane, you all know. And the lipids have hydrophobic tails and, hydrophobic heads and hydrophilic tails, if you may, however you look at it. So these hydrophobic regions are embedded within the membrane, lipid bilayer here. And the other region, which is hydrophilic, is protruding to the cytoplasm. And it's an inositol group, usually. So this inositol group is quite a few hydroxyl group, potentially can be phosphorylated by various kinases. So one kinase here, phosphoinositol kinase, can phosphorylate, for example, the position 5 and position 4. And then another enzyme can act on it, and produce diacylglycerol, which is another so-called second messenger. In other words, another layer of protein, another layer of molecule which can elicit a particular signal. In this particular case, the ISL glycerol will lead to PI3K signaling. And the other product is inositol 145 triphosphate or IP3. Now, the PI3K kinase, for example, can use this as a substrate and then convert it into inositol trans, for example, phosphorylated at 5, 4, and 3. That's called phosphatidyl inositol 3, 4, 5 triphosphate or acronym PIP3. And that's an important signaling component, as you're going to see here. And this enzyme is also very important, PI3 kinase or PI3K, and its product, PIP3. So what does it do? So this is the RAS protein again. So this is a PI3K catalytic C-terminal lobe, that enzyme which you just saw. That can interact or bind to the RAS protein, and these are different domains of that particular PI3K. Here it is the RBD, and this is the RAS protein sitting here, and that's the catalytic domain of the PI3K. So once this protein, this enzyme is activated by the RAS protein which you saw previously, okay? So that is why I showed you this here. So the RAS protein, PI3K, can bind, or RAS can bind the PI3K and activate it and produce PIP3. So we were here, yeah, PIP3. So in order to produce PIP3, PIK kinase need to be activated by RAS. And once that is activated, what happens is that, so this is hanging inside the cytoplasm, right, on the membrane. So in the cytoplasm, there is proteins like AKT or PKB. These type of proteins has what is called the pH domain. And this particular pH domain is a sequence of amino acids on the protein, nothing else. But that has the ability to be detected by the PIP3 phosphorylated protein. So the PIP3 can detect the pH domain and interact with the AKT protein. And in the, as a process, as a result, it becomes phosphorylated and active. So AKT-PKB is inactive when it is not phosphorylated, but once it is phosphorylated by PIP3, becomes active. So this is now attached to the membrane through the PIP3, and once it is phosphorylated, it is very active in signaling. And a detailed crystal from the crystal structure, you can see here, some of the amino acids which are very important, for example, one is GLU70. So what happens here is the enzyme reaction here. PI3K you already saw. PI3K takes PIP2 or it's the substrate, acts on it and converts into PIP3, a triphosphate here. And there is another enzyme or protein called P10 which will reverse this reaction. So in a normal cell, you can't say that, okay, this is a villain or this is a hero. Both are needed. So there is a tight balance. When you need AKT signaling, this protein is active. When it is not needed, P10 will shut it off. But in cancer cell, what happens is that this enzyme can get stuck, just as the RAS we were talking about, the similar principle. When a particular amino acid is mutated, for example, in several types of some tumors, you can see this GLU17 gets mutated. Once that is mutated, this enzyme is very active, extremely active. So that means always there is excessive signaling. Also, another way to inactivate it is when the tumor is P10 negative, or P10, this tumor, which is a tumor suppressor because it converts the active protein to the inactive one. So that tumor suppressor is mutated here, P10 minus. So you can see intense signaling, intense expression of the phosphorylated AKT. You can see this high AKT content and low AKT. P10 minus minus, high AKT, P10 plus minus, low AKT relatively. So you can regulate this protein both by this increased activity of this and decreased activity of this. So that's about that mutation I spoke about. A somatic mutation in human breast, colorectal and ovarian cancers that result in glutamic acid to lysine substitution at amino acid 17 in the lipid binding pocket that includes the pH domain of AKT1 has been identified. This results in activation of AKT by pathological localization to the plasma membrane, stimulating downstream signaling, transforms cells and induces leukemia in mice. So that's how they experimentally proved that this domain, this particular mutation is important. And then they correlated that presence of that mutation is there in several human cancers. So the mutation is here. When this pH domain is mutated, this become high affinity for this. It cannot be unphosphorylated and inactivated. It becomes always attached to the plasma membrane and keep firing signals. So how does it do that? When I say firing means AKT, PKB, when it become active, you can see it phosphorylates another bunch of proteins downstream called GSK3 beta, which prevents proliferation. So this is a negative regulator of proliferation. What the active AKT will do is it inactivates the negative regulator, which means there is positive proliferation, right? And also this is HIF1, it is hypoxia inducing factor, which is by the way needed for angiogenesis, you saw in the very first slide. And so that is activating angiogenesis, and AKT can activate this factor, so it will enhance angiogenesis. Similarly, in this particular case, BAD is a protein which enhances apoptosis, but AKT will block it. So again, all this enhances the capability of oncogenesis. A whole table of some of these anti-apoptotic proteins, proliferative proteins and growth regulating proteins regulated by this process. Some of these proteins which are substrate for AKT, PKB, and some description of those proteins. This isn't just a sample should show diagram. As a picture here, a normal pancreatic islet, and when you have constitutively active AKT kinase, you can see the cells become huge because there is a lot of growth without control. And activation of this particular PI3K pathway in several tumors, that's the whole bunch of tumors as examples are shown in this table. And now we touched upon virus early on, but yet another way how some viruses can subvert cellular signaling to transform a cell to a cancer cell. So you already saw this. This is one of the best examples how a virus can enhance oncogenesis process. Another example is in the human papilloma virus, which causes cervical cancer in humans. Two major tumor suppressor proteins, P53 and retinoblastoma protein, both are inactivated by, P53 is inactivated by viral protein, papilloma viral protein E6, papilloma viral protein E7 inactivates RB. So two major tumor suppressors are inactivated in this cervical carcinoma. And another one is that E5 protein causes sustained activation of PDGF receptor, and estrogen hormone will increase its ability to do this. So this is an example of how viral infection can lead to oncogenic signaling. In this case, for example, in the cervical cancer, P53 or RB is not mutated. So you don't need necessarily mutation of a tumor suppressor to generate cancer. That tumor suppressor can be inactivated by other means. For example, here binding this E6 can bind to normal P53 and keep it inactive. So that also will lead to cancer. So now some of the consequences or new areas which are coming into focus in the last few years. So that's again from that review which you already have earlier, not by me, but in the previous lecture, I think, was given to you. So the tumor cells have to avoid immune destruction. It has to avoid, it is responsive to tumor promoting inflammation. And also genomic instability and mutation of the genome obviously will lead to cancer. And then deregulation of cellular energetics. Metabolism of a cell, or how cells produce energy, has a lot to do in controlling the cancer process. So that we will take up in the next lecture. I will be talking mostly on this process the next time. And these ones you would have be already heard or will be hearing in various other lectures. So how signal transduction can be exploited for cancer therapy? So one can imagine all these various characteristics which we saw in the beginning can be interfered by various strategies, and that's going on, and with various extent of success. For example, the cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitors can act on these growth suppressors, growth suppressor evaders, and EGFR inhibitors is already being used for block some of the tyrosine kinase receptor signaling. Like that, many of these steps can be interfered are being tried by in various laboratories and companies all over the world to come up with effective drugs. Now, remember that what is effective in one cancer may not be effective in another cancer, because that, for example, when you say sustained proliferation signaling, if you have a drug against, for example, a breast cancer, that may not be effective in another cancer like prostate or ovarian or whatever, or colon, because even though they involve tyrosine kinase, the kinase involved may be different, and therefore, and their ligands can be different. So depending on that, some of these drugs are effective for certain cancers, but not effective against similar other cancers. And here is another way to look at this, various steps in these pathways. You saw the activation of the tyrosine kinase and a whole bunch of proteins, and we saw all these, how AKT gets activated, and it being GSK, it blocks GSK, and all those things you saw it. Many of these steps can be, are being tried to how to block it with various agents. As I said, some of them have been relatively successful, some of them have not been successful. And that's a table of agents that target RB2 or HER2 and RB3 or HER3 for the treatment of human cancer. Some of the agents' compounds which has been developed by various companies. And that's another table to show you another list of drug, cancer, and target. Which you already saw here, which I'm just showing you the same slide I showed you earlier. So this would happen, and if you can block the signaling, one of these steps here, then you would think that, okay, you can fight cancer, which is true, but many times what happens in the clinic is that, for example, this is another way to look at the tyrosine kinase receptor signaling. When that binds a ligand, in this particular case HER2, when it binds the ligand, gets activated, and as you saw, it activates PI3K, and then it also can activate one of the proteins which are familiar to us, but early on, the SARC protein, which is sitting in the cytoplasm, it gets phosphorylated just as PI3K phosphorylate AKT here. Another protein gets phosphorylated is SARC. SARC can block P10. In other words, SARC can, so this will, this process, phosphorylation, will activate a protein by called SARC, oncoprotein. That oncoprotein can block this enzyme. So then what happens? The conversion of this active form to the inactive form does not happen, right? So the product of this process itself can enhance the process by that. And the other one you already have seen, that it can activate AKT, and the, through mTOR it can lead to tumorigenesis. Now, if you have a drug which will block the ligand binding, and that drug clinically used is called trastuzumab, which is a HER2 inhibitor antibody, humanized antibody, and it is commercially called, or in the clinic it is called trastuzumab. When that binds, it cannot bind the HER2 to this receptor. So the activation is blocked. The SARC is not phosphorylated, therefore SARC is not active to block P10. So P10 is active here, right? So what you would think is that when you block this with this drug, everything is looking good. P10 is there to decrease the phosphorylation of AKT by dephosphorylating the protein, and AKT is not active much. And you can, if you combine that with another drug, which is at this step, the product mTOR, which is rapamycin, you can, or everolimus. These are some of those drugs which can block mTOR. So if you combine this and this, you have tumor suppression, which works in many cases. But what happens in many tumors is that it doesn't work. There, what happens is that the those tumors, P10 is deleted. If you don't have P10, or P10 is inactive for whatever reason, the mutated or deleted, you don't have SARC, of course, but if you don't have P10, AKT phosphorylation will still be there, although to a lesser extent, because this is a block, but still AKT can fire to some extent, and then this become resistant to this drug. So drug resistance, just to this slide is to illustrate the problem of encountering signal transduction or developing drugs against this to fight cancer. So even if you have a drug, the cells are smart. They have, depending on some situation, it can have changes either downstream or upstream, some of the components in the pathway. If they are defective, your drug will fail. So this is an example of that. So what you have learned today is that underlying major themes in the modulation of signal transduction is intrinsic activity of signaling molecules, and concentration of signaling molecules matters, because when there are lot of HER2, for example, you don't need a ligand for them to dimerize and activate. And also intracellular localization of signaling molecule is important. Example, AKT and RAF. RAF is in the cytoplasmic soup, if you may, before it gets activated by RAS. Only when RAS gets activated, it can bind the RAF in the cytoplasm and bring it to the membrane, and then the whole series starts. Same way, AKT is in the cytoplasm, and through the PI3K pathway, it can bind to that and start activating or phosphorylating other proteins downstream. And post-translational modifications, already I mentioned to you how important they are in determining protein-protein interaction. If protein tyrosine, in a tyrosine residue in a protein is not phosphorylated, that will not be detected by another protein, for example, which are necessary for signaling. So in each type of the complexity of signaling in cancer is that in each type of cell, the signaling, the signaling work in a combinatorial fashion to ensure that proliferation occurs in the right place at the right time during development and repair, normal. Moreover, different cell types use different combination of pathways to regulate their growth and division. This explains why the biochemistry of cancer is so complex, because biochemistry of our normal cells are so complex. So the cancer is obviously happening to those cells are also very extremely complex. Now, challenges to drug discovery, you already saw the resistance issue. There can be differences in signaling pathways that are altered among various cancer cells. In other words, defects that cause the conversion of a normal cell to a cancer cell need not be the same in all cancers. Moreover, signaling pathways can change during progression of cancer. A particular cancer sensitive or responding to a drug at one stage need not be sensitive to another stage to the same drug. That's how drug resistance and cancer recurrence occurs. You treat the patient, tumor disappears temporarily, but then it comes back. One reason is that they are no more sensitive to drug with which they were treated. Further, of course, variation in drug delivery, drug metabolism, drug resistance, and drug specificity on cancer cells with minimal effect on normal cells are also major concerns. When you develop a drug, you have to be also concerned about what pathways changes can make the cells resistant, and also how can you minimize the effect on normal cells. Because many of these proteins, as you saw in the signal transduction, in cancer cells they are not strangers, they are not coming from viruses, they are coming except in the case of some cancers like cervical cancer, but otherwise they are all in our body. They are changed by various processes. And then, of course, the old adage that prevention is better than cure, of course, if we can prevent it, then we are much better off. But how do you prevent? Because the challenge is that you have to develop effective prevention strategy with the minimal side effect, and safety and timing. Many compounds which some companies or some agencies claim as preventive agents are not safe when you take it, is because it has its own side effects. Sometimes side effects can be worse than the disease, and that's why some of the chemo preventive agents have been withdrawn in last few years for that particular reason in certain cancers, for example. So better understanding of signaling abnormalities in cancer cells should develop effective prevention strategies. So understanding the signal transduction in more detail and precision is important in designing more effective drugs. So I'll stop there, and if you have any questions, be happy to answer now, or anytime later, you can email me. Anything now? No? Either you understood everything or you didn't get anything. So, and the exam questions will be in general based on the concepts. So you don't have to, I don't expect you to remember all the names which you saw there on various slides, but you do have to remember some of the important names. Of course, if you need to explain a concept, you need to remember the names of the major players, right? But I wouldn't expect you to remember all the other names or anything like that. Mostly it will be based on the whether you understand the concept or not. So I'll see you next week to talk about metabolism.